Hi, this is Brian French with EstateSettlement.com. Welcome to our radio show where we discuss important topics about estate planning and how to deal with affairs of elder care and elder law. Today's special guest is Richard M. Barron, and Richard is an elder law and estate planning attorney based in the Dallas, Texas area. Richard has over 20 years' experience in dealing with estate planning and elder law, and has a Juris Doctorate degree from Texas Tech University. Welcome, Richard, to the Estate Settlement Talk Show.
Well, thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here.
Richard, in looking at estate planning, you know, you deal in some specific niches. Can you tell me a little bit about the risks involved? Obviously, there's financial issues when somebody dies, but I take it there's also important things to look at legally when people get sick.
Yes, certainly, Brian. When we talk about elder law, it's a niche of estate planning. We do a lot of estate planning, but in traditional estate planning, basically what they're trying to do is answer the question of what happens to someone's property upon their death. We do that as well, but we also think about something else, and that is, what if that person lives and becomes incapacitated, either physically or mentally? Now, what happens to their property? What happens to their income? And most especially, what happens to their spouse and their family? Because usually, in those set of circumstances, if these provisions haven't been provided for, then the family is going to be at a loss as to how to possibly qualify this person for government benefits such as Medicaid or VA without the necessary planning documents. So that is kind of the difference between a traditional estate planner and an elder law attorney who does a lot of Medicaid and VA qualification.
It seems to me that some of these issues can be pretty complex. If somebody has, let's say, a small business, that can be a major asset of theirs, can be part of their income, and if they become incapacitated, then doing transactions and the affairs of the business can be encumbered by a person who becomes disabled. Do you see that happen at all?
Absolutely. What we see in most cases is that an individual will have what we consider the basic estate planning document, and that's a will. But what a lot of people don't realize is that a will only operates upon the happening of two things. One is that they have to die, and two, it has to be probated. During their lifetime, that will gives no one authority to act on behalf of that individual. That's where we come into the powers of attorney, both for finances and for health care. We're also looking at end-of-life decision-making, as well as, and this is where I think the most important part is to be able to manage or to have that individual be able to designate who they would want to manage their finances and their health care if they're not able to do so themselves. So we're more concerned with that aspect of planning, and there are even complicated aspects with regards to that. And one of the things you were mentioning is someone running a small business. Many times that might be in a corporate structure, but if it's a partnership or a sole proprietor, then that individual has even more things that need to be considered, because that's the livelihood of not only that individual, but possibly the livelihood of the spouse as well. So you do definitely want to make sure that that transition takes place. The other aspect is that I am seeing more and more late in life marriages in which both individuals have lost their first spouse, usually through a death, and then marry, in which there are two separate families. And that sometimes can be a very difficult planning process to be able to take all the equities and make sure that everybody is treated fairly. So they don't think about some of these aspects. That's part of the job. That's just bringing up those what-ifs that they probably have not thought about, and then making that into a plan that will serve their needs not only during their lifetime but also upon their death, to be able to handle these types of financial and healthcare matters.
So this is legal planning that kind of dovetails with financial planning, would you say?
Yes, the financial planning is definitely important, because a lot of times what they don't realize is that we may have a husband and wife. I mean, even in their first marriage, no divorces, same family and everything else. But husband and or wife would have some sort of a qualified account, an IRA or a 401k or something in which that spouse is the sole owner. And what the question or the response I usually get is that the other spouse says, well, I'm the beneficiary, so I should be able to access that account. When in fact, unless they have been specifically named on the account as an authorized user, that other spouse does not have the authority to go in during the one spouse's lifetime and acquire that IRA or other qualified account. So what we do is we try to counsel them as to finding out ahead of time if that event takes place, if someone becomes incapacitated and does not die, because a beneficiary is only upon the death of that person. And so what we try to do is encourage them to go and discuss this with their financial planners, with their banks or their human resources department, so that there isn't a surprise, because when you need that great estate plan or a great disability plan, it's too late. The documents and the other steps have not taken place up to that point, then that can leave the spouse in a very bad situation.
Now, you also work in the area of Medicaid planning and helping people qualify for Medicaid. What is the biggest myth about Medicaid planning and qualification?
By far, the biggest myth about, I mean, that's not only with regard to the general population, but with professionals as well, is that we have what they call a five-year look back. And if you do not basically transfer all of your property out of your name and into someone else's name and then wait that 5 years, that you will not be able to qualify for Medicaid. And that is just simply not the case. Quite regularly will qualify, especially in a spousal situation. If one spouse goes into the nursing home, we can transfer usually 100% of the estate and almost all of the income. There is what they call a minimum monthly needs allowance, and that will allow us to transfer income over to that well spouse. And if we can't get all the assets, there are other means in which we can transfer that property over to the community spouse or the spouse that remains at home. And so what I encourage people is find out first, because what we hear most often is that, I know I should have come in earlier, that we, you know, needed to give away everything that we have in order to qualify for Medicaid. Well, most people don't want to give away all their assets, and I encourage them not to. You may or may not need nursing home care. And if that's the case, then you really need to keep those assets, you know, in your name, so that it can provide for your care during your lifetime. And when it becomes necessary to rearrange those assets, then if the documents have been put into place, we would be able to do that, getting someone qualified for Medicaid. Even a single individual, in many instances, we can protect between 50 and 60% of their estate and get them qualified much sooner than the five-year look back.
So they don't have to spend it all and give it all away. They can contact an attorney like yourself that deals with this specialty area of the law of Medicaid planning, and so they can qualify. Now, nursing home expense can be pretty big item, can it?
Well, actually, right now in the state of Texas, it's right at $5,000 a month. It's just a little below that. And that's what the state is saying is our averaged monthly cost of nursing home care. Now, you can go into other states. Ohio, I think, is up around $6,200. And you can get up into the Northeast, and it's approaching $10,000. So if you are able to qualify for those benefits, the other thing I hear is, I've just got too much money, I won't be able to qualify. No, there are things that we can do in order to preserve those funds and still get you qualified, some instances almost immediately, and if that's not possible, then very likely within a period of time that is much less than that five-year look back. So, yes, I think the best thing to do is find someone who does this on a regular basis, and find out for sure. Find out what the facts are. Most of the time, I'm trying to unlearn people that come in here that have had well-meaning individuals give them advice. And I'm saying, you know, their family attorney, the CPA, financial advisor, you just simply don't know the complexity of these rules and how to utilize the rules in order to preserve your estate.
So people can protect a portion of their assets, and then they can save the, $60,000 a year or so in nursing care expense by talking to an elder law specialist like yourself. That's amazing.
That's right. It's a win-win situation because we have been able to help many a family. Very rarely can we not save some money, regardless of the size of the estate. And someone who has a $30,000 estate might be just as concerned about having at least some money left over, because if someone is in a nursing home on Medicaid, Medicaid does not pay for everything. They don't pay for clothes, for eyeglasses, for dental work, things of that nature. So if we can preserve some of those assets to be able to handle those needs, not going out of the pockets of the family members or the spouse.
Now, veterans have unique circumstances, too. There will be veteran benefits that they need to be protected, and then spouses can receive benefits from veteran programs. Is that true?
Yes, it is. What we found in my practice was we just started simply asking the people that were calling in whether or not they were a veteran, are they the surviving spouse of a veteran. More often than not, we would have a veteran that would be entitled to some benefits that they simply were not aware of. Veterans does not get out and publicize a lot of these types of benefits, but the benefit is called pension. Most people understand it as aid and attendance, but it can pay a husband and wife up to $2,052 a month to help them offset the increasing medical expenses that they might be incurring as they age. There are some rules and regulations that we have to abide by. There's some income limitations, and we have to offset income with expenses, with medical expenses. And then you get into the fact that you're going to have to possibly qualify for Medicaid. Right now, VA does not have a look-back period, so we can gift away their property either into someone else or into an irrevocable trust and then immediately qualify them for VA, for these VA benefits. However, there is pending legislation that will impose a 3-year look-back on the veterans' benefits as well, but they're still there. They come in handy when we're dealing with at-home circumstances and assisted living, in which those two normally don't have Medicaid benefits associated with them. And even if they get into the nursing home, especially a single individual, it can help pay for that cost during a period of time that Medicaid may not be paying for their care, and we have to pay privately until we get to a point where Medicaid will start paying.
Richard, when you're looking in and you're doing some estate planning work for people, a lot of people think that they can kind of do things themselves, and what they'll do is they'll set up accounts and joint ownership. Is that a solution, or is it not?
The joint, and this is, again, one of those issues that we discussed, because there is such a lack of understanding, but there is what they call joint tenancy with right of survivorship. That means that those individuals who are named on, let's say, a bank account, if one of them should die, then the account is transferred to the remaining joint tenant, or tenants as the case might be. Typically, in a husband and wife situation, that's not such a bad outcome. But what I find is that people will put their children on these accounts in what they consider to be a convenience, so that should they not be able to take care of their finances for whatever reason, whether or not it's because of an illness or they're in the hospital or things of that nature, then the child could simply come in and do that for them. Unfortunately, in many instances, that child is put on as a joint tenant with right of survivorship. So what we have to be concerned with is that child could have creditors out there, the IRS, They could have a bankruptcy, they could have themselves become disabled, or they could have a divorce. All of those things could impact the parents' account because they're in that joint tenancy. So I really try to encourage them to take the children off. If that's what their concern is, let's do a revocable living trust, and the same effect is produced, but the child is a trustee of the trust and does not own the trust property, so that their creditors would have no claim to it. However, the child would be able to act on behalf of the parent.
Right. And there's constantly shifting laws, and I know the estate tax exemption's been kind of a yo-yo over the last 5 or so years. What is the estate tax exempt amount that people love? Do you have inheritance tax in Texas?
No, we don't have an inheritance tax in Texas. But we are still subject to the federal inheritance tax, and because we're a community property state, the estate would have to be in excess of $10 million because each spouse would be entitled to up to $5 million in exempt inheritance. But in most instances, that's well beyond the average individual's net worth, so it doesn't come into play all that often. It is something that would need to be considered with higher income, higher asset type individuals. The other aspect that comes up is the gift tax. And most people are under the assumption that they can give away $13,000 per person per year. That would be a way to reduce their assets so that if they had to qualify for Medicaid, Medicaid wouldn't count those gifts. And that's totally wrong. The gifting part of that, the $13,000, that's an IRS-type rule. Medicaid does not hold that same type of rule. And they will count all of those gifts, all of those transfers of $13,000 as gifts, and therefore will penalize them. Where if they had just held on to them, we would probably have been able to preserve that kind of money between the spouses and not have it have to be transferred out to a child. In most of the cases, once it's transferred, the money's pretty much gone. We can't get it back. So I do try to inform people that we can give more than $13,000 per person. And again, the gift tax, you can have up to $5 million in your lifetime before any kind of gift tax is going to be assessed. There may need to be a gift tax return filed, but there's no tax owed until you get above that threshold.
So assets that might have a potential to appreciate greatly, it would make sense to maybe gift those before you think they kind of hit the home run kind of deal. That might be a bit of a strategy if you're looking at doing that gifting ahead of time.
Yes. In fact, I don't do a lot of tax work, but I understand some of it. And what a lot of times what folks will do is they'll want to give their, the biggest thing that you hear is, I don't want my home going to the nursing home. It literally will not go to the nursing home. But so as a result of that thought is that they will get that house away to their children in advance and retain, a life estate to be able to live there for the remainder of their life. But in not a lot of instances, but in many instances, those parents may have purchased that property 20, 30, 40 years ago. And they may have purchased it at $20,000, and now it's worth $250,000. Well, if that child is given that property, first of all, no homestead is going to be associated with it. And so if they then in the future sell it, they're going to have to claim a basis in the property as being the basis that the parents had. Whereas if it was inherited, then they would have what they call stepped-up bases, and they would lose all that capital gain. So there are some things tax-wise that do need to be considered, just depending on, the individual. It's always a case-by-case basis, but obviously that is something that if it becomes too complex that I would recommend that, they seek some more advice from their CPA or whoever handles their taxes for them.
Sure. And looking looking at estate planning, a lot of people think that there's no need to do any kind of creation of trust accounts. But actually, when people just use a simple will, isn't much of what they would like to keep private kind of in the public record when you just do a will? And does a trust kind of create some degree of privacy?
Yes, it certainly does. When we draw up a trust agreement, you know, I will emphasize that the will is still a very important document because we never know what's going to happen in the future, and a properly drawn will can resolve a lot of problems. However, most people are just very fearful of probate and have heard just horror stories with regards to their estate going through probate, which is a very public type thing. And the public part of it is that there are files that are open to the public, so anybody could go and examine the will and inventory and things of that nature. Whereas if you have a revocable living trust and you actually transfer the property into the trust, in other words, if you have a piece of real estate, that piece of real estate has to be transferred from you, you know, the one that owns that real estate, to themselves as trustee of their trust. If that's not done, then the piece of property, the asset, will not be considered a part of the trust and may have to go through probate anyhow. So it is a very convenient way to be able to maintain an individual's independence, and that's what a lot of people want. They don't want someone coming in and trying to take over their financial affairs. So they can remain independent utilizing a revocable living trust, and should that change, in other words, should they at some point in the future lack the capacity to manage their affairs, especially their financial affairs, then they can name their children as alternates. And this is a very private type situation. It's only the trust document should not be dispersed to anybody else, even though a lot of institutions want to see the whole trust document. I will counsel them to try to avoid giving that out. But you're right. It does pose the possibility of not having to probate the will as long as everything has been transferred properly into the trust. Now, the other situation that comes up, too, is most wills out there are what they call sweetheart wills, and that means that all of the property is left to the husband or to the wife. That works as long as there's not a disability and someone goes into the nursing home and then acquires nursing home Medicaid. And the reason for that is that Medicaid spouse has to have assets that are below $2,000. And if, lo and behold, the other spouse should predecease that spouse, and their will says, I leave everything to my spouse who's in the nursing home, well, then that's going to destroy that Medicaid planning. So we make sure that if we're going to leave it to the other spouse in the will, then we leave it to them in what they call a special needs trust, or really it's an asset protection trust. So the money is available for their care if they need it. It doesn't supplement or supplant Medicaid. It supplements Medicaid for those things that Medicaid simply doesn't pay for. So there's a lot of things that we can do with the trust in order to protect the property regardless of what happens.
You know, it's a kind of an observation. We get a lot of calls at estatesettlement.com of people trying to resolve conflicts with an estate, and it's sad to see that many times, because people have not done the appropriate planning, a lot of family relationships are at risk, and people are not getting along, and you know, and these are. It's just a tragic circumstance that we see when people avoid planning, don't do the proper documents. Many people don't even have a will, so it's it's kind of a free ball, so to speak, after the fact, and it leads to a good deal of disorder and really some difficult times for a lot of family members.
Yeah, and it could come as a shock. I mean, the best gift you can give to your loved ones, either be your spouse or your children, is to properly draft both an estate plan and a disability plan, so they know what it is that you would want done with your property or with your health care, or you know, upon that event that all of us are going to face sooner or later, that end of life planning. Do you know? to take care of those well in advance is really the best gift they can give to those folks that are going to have to pick up the pieces after the emotional aspect wears off and continue on with their life. And if it's not been properly planned for, there are just so many circumstances that can come up that will detrimentally affect either that spouse or those family members. Again, I get back to there's many second marriages in which children that are part of the new marriage were really children from a prior marriage for that spouse. And that can definitely influence how the property is being distributed if they have not taken the time to just produce a will, if not anything else. But as I try to emphasize to them, that will only takes effect upon their death. They really need these powers of attorney and other documents so that should that crisis come about, that those things have been put into place. And the other thing is, just because someone has a power of attorney doesn't mean another party has to accept that. In other words, financial institutions, banks and brokerage houses and things of that nature, we have found routinely just turn these documents down as part of their policy. So you definitely not only need to have the documents, but make sure that whoever's handling your finances will cooperate with regard to your financial plans should that event take place. And the other thing is most standard documents don't have the necessary language contained in them. Because with a power of attorney, unless you have the authority from whoever signs that power of attorney to be able to rearrange their assets, and in many instances rearrange them or retitle them into the name of the power of attorney or the agent that was named, they don't have the power to do that. And so there are certain phrases and other aspects to the Medicaid and VA planning type powers of attorney that aren't in your standard state durable power of attorney.
We're speaking to Richard Barron, and Richard Barron is a elder law attorney based in the Dallas, Texas area. Now, Richard, if people have questions about elder law planning or estate planning, can they contact you? And do you have? I've been to your website, and that is the Texas Elder Law Attorney. .com website, so our listeners are welcome to go to that site, I take it. But can they contact you directly, Richard?
Absolutely. We have an 800 number. It's 1-800-939-9093. We have offices in the Plano area, which serves the Dallas-Fort Worth metropolitan area. And I also have an office in a small town called Whitesboro, but it kind of services the growing population that we have just north of the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And we operate where if they call in, if they have questions, we'll get certain information from them. We never charge to give out that information or to gather the information that we need. I even will do the initial consultation at no charge because I need to find out what their circumstances are. Once I know that, then I can quote them a fee. We do flat fees so they know exactly what it's going to cost, what we're going to do before they sign up. So I always encourage people to give us a call and to, you know, if they have questions with regards to the planning aspect of it, Medicaid or VA benefits.
Well, it certainly sounds like a win-win situation where people, you'll give them that free initial consultation, they'll get an understanding of the process, and they'll understand what the fees are, and they'll most certainly understand what the benefits are, and there seems to be quite a few when you look at both during life issues when it comes to, you know, people obviously today are living longer and have, you know, going into nursing homes is pretty common. So we can see that there's a lot of potential savings when people come to you early. What, again, is your contact number, Richard? How can they reach you directly?
Yeah, you can call me at 1-800-939-9093.
And they are welcome to also visit your website, and that is TexasElderLawAttorney.com, www.TexasElderLawAttorney.com. attorney.com. There's a great deal of information, some free reports on the website. Richard, thank you so much for being on the Estate Settlement Radio Show. And again, we welcome our guests and listeners to contact Richard directly if you have any elder law issue that you'd like to discuss with Richard. Thanks again, Richard.
All right, Brian, thank you, and I appreciate you inviting me on your show.